Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I do hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on April 27th, 2025, under the headline, Pioneer Lady Doctor was Oregon's Own Modern Prometheus. It's in three parts. Today we are reading part two. Here we go. Chapter 2, The Pioneer Lady Doctor. The old man had died penniless and left behind no relatives who could claim his corpse and give it proper burial. But the Roseburg medical community was happy to help. It was the early 1870s, and although the practice of medicine was making great strides, things were still relatively primitive. Dr. Robert Koch would not discover pathogenic germs for another decade, and most of the breakthroughs in the medical field came from dissecting cadavers. Freshly bereaved family members did not care for the idea of a room of frock-coated medical ghouls slicing up the mortal remains of their loved ones, so they very seldom granted permission, and when an unclaimed body appeared, it was not an opportunity to be let slip. There were six MD doctors in Roseburg at that time, and all of them had at one time or another had the old man for a patient. Now they all got together and scheduled an autopsy and dissection. As they got ready to start, one of their number, a stiff, elderly doctor by the name of Dr. Palmer, suggested that they send an invitation to the new lady doctor to attend. A round of chuckles greeted this. The docs all thought it was a great idea. As a joke, of course. The motion was promptly seconded and unanimously approved. A messenger was dispatched to the lady doctor with the invitation. "I knew this meant no honor for me," Dr. Owens recalled in her memoir years later. "But I said, give the doctors my compliments and say that I will be there in a few minutes." She knew the invitation had been intended as a humiliating reminder that as a member of the fair sex, her feminine sensitivity would prevent her from doing actual doctor work. The old man would, of course, be naked at the autopsy. The dissection would include elements of the male reproductive system that ladies were expected to be loath to lay hands upon or even look at. It was, in other words, a bluff, and she intended to call it. The messenger darted off to deliver the message, and Bethenia discreetly followed as close behind him as she could. He ran into the building where the body lay, and she stepped up to the door as he went in. "I heard him say in excited tones, 'She said to give you her compliments and that she'd be here in a minute,'" Dr. Owens recounted in her memoir. "Then came a roar of laughter, after which I quietly opened the door and walked in, went forward and shook hands with Dr. Hoover."
"Do you know that the autopsy is on the genital organs?" Dr. Hoover asked her diffidently.
"No," said Dr. Owen, "but one part of the human body should be as sacred to the physician as another." Faced now with the undeniable backfiring of what he'd anticipated would be a delicious little prank, Dr. Palmer drew himself up.
"I object to a woman's being present at a male autopsy," he thundered. "If she is allowed to remain, I shall retire."
For the other doctors, though, this was going a bit too far. It had, after all, been his idea to invite her. Also, they all knew that he and Dr. Owens didn't like each other. Prior to her stint in medical school, when Bethenia had been working as a nurse, they'd had a little clash of wills at a patient's bedside, for which he bore her a lasting grudge. So not only was she allowed to remain, they let her lead the dissection, doubtless hoping she'd make some sort of mistake that they could point to as evidence of a woman's inadequacy to the task of practicing medicine. When she didn't supply them with one, they were all somewhat ungracious in their disappointment, but the people of Roseburg thought it was hilarious. "When I had at last finished the dissection, the audience, not the doctors, gave me three cheers," Dr. Owens wrote. "And as I passed out and down on my way home, the street was lined on both sides with men, women, and children, all anxious to get a look at the woman who dared, to see what sort of strange anomalous being she was." It was a remarkable start to an even more remarkable career, the more so as Bethenia was just over 30 years old when she launched it. It was also not a second-act career, but a fourth act. She'd been a wife, then a teacher, then a hat shop entrepreneur, and now a physician. She had seen much of the world and conquered more than most. Roseburg was too small a pond for a fish as big as Dr. Owen hoped to become, so as soon as her affairs were properly in order, she moved to Portland. Her practice soon thrived there. She was one of the earliest adopters of aseptic medicine. This was still the 1870s, before germ theory had been proven, but there were many reasons a wide-awake doctor might suspect an unseen microscopic disease vector. In fact, Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister had pretty much proven as much. But in spite of this evidence, the medical profession was still full of stubborn old bonesaw jockeys who still regarded their blood-stained frock coats the way Navy guys do their coffee cups, taking pride in the crusted-on filth, going out of their way to get them stiff with dried gore, and performing surgery with bare, unwashed hands. Dr. Owen set up her practice with electrical and chemical bath facilities, a therapeutic practice she'd learned in eclectic school, which nobody else in Portland was doing. The electric baths were especially hard to pull off as they had to be powered by elaborate battery banks. Remember, this was a good 20 years before electric grid power became available. Word spread, and soon her practice was booming. Meanwhile, baby George graduated from Berkeley, enrolled in Willamette Medical School, and graduated with his MD. Bethenia's younger sister, most likely she who took over the millinery shop, finished her course of study at Mills College in Oakland, in which Bethenia was supporting her. So in 1877, feeling it was her turn, she started looking back east for a suitable mainstream medical college from which to earn an actual MD degree. She initially had hoped to get into Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, but after meeting with its top professor, she learned that admissions were controlled by a board of directors that was 50 years behind the times and dead set against letting women in. He sent her instead to the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, where her application was, of course, pounced upon at once by the registrar. College life for Dr. Owens was very busy. In her memoir, she gives us a glimpse of what life was like for her, and it is quite a regimen. "It was my custom to rise at 4 a.m., take a cold bath followed by vigorous exercise," she writes. "Then study till breakfast at 7. I allowed myself half an hour for each meal. After supper came quizzes, then study till 9 p.m. when I retired to sleep soundly." The program was a 2-year one, but as that schedule indicates, it was an intensive 2 years. And after it was complete, Dr. Bethenia Owens, M.D., had every credential that she would need to take the place she'd earned in the society she had, in a very real sense, conquered. Already one of Portland's most well-known citizens, Dr. Owens now moved from strength to strength. Not only was she a full-fledged physician, she was a double doctor with training and experience in therapeutic techniques from both mainstream and eclectic medical traditions. She went on to marry a childhood friend, Colonel John Adair, in 1884, and changed her name to Owens Adair. He seems to have been a bit of a problem for her, being susceptible to pouring out money on ill-considered and dreamy schemes, but they made it work, and for the next 10 years they lived on a farm near Astoria, where Bethenia practiced as a country doctor. They tried to have another child together, but by now she was in her late 40s, and after the little tyke died at the age of 3 days, they apparently decided not to try again. She retired from regular practice in 1905, at the fairly young age of 65. But her retirement would not be a quiet one. No, Bethenia Owens Adair intended her retirement to be the commencement of her fifth career, the one in which she hoped to do the most good in the world of all, as a political activist. And, of course, this is where it all went horribly wrong. We'll talk about that tomorrow, in the third and final part of this 3-part series. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Say, are you an audiobook listener? Do you enjoy old pre-war pulp stories? Tarzan of the Apes, Conan the Barbarian, The Call of Cthulhu, stuff like that? Or early Victorian penny dreadful fiction like Sweeney Todd, Vardy the Vampire, Highwayman Dick Turpin? If so, you might enjoy the audiobooks that I have out there in the world. Easiest way to find them is with a search for my name on audible.com. And there's a couple of Oregon history titles I've done, too. Check them out if you're so inclined. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of your Thursday with good stuff. Bye now.